Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a man who has conducted himself in a most exemplary fashion in several different capacities in that war is our first guest. A repeat appearance, I'm very pleased to say, by Congressman Chris Stewart, who represents the people of the 2nd District of Utah. His record of accomplishment is hard to summarize in the short time we have available. Let me simply say that he is a command Air Force pilot, setting world records, the author of 17 books, including New York Times bestsellers. He is, in addition, as I've indicated, a member of the House of Representatives and serves on its Appropriations Committee as well as its Intelligence Committee. And Congressman, it's always a delight to have you with us. Thanks for taking a few minutes to catch up. It's good to talk with you.
It's always good to be with you, sir, and you're overly gracious in your introductions, but thank you.
Well, I truly mean it. It doesn't do justice to your record, but I'm glad to have a chance to talk with you a bit about several things, including something that you've been on from very early on, and that is the Zika virus. I'd like to get your sense of what's afoot with this thing and how serious a public health problem you believe it represents.
You know, I don't think that we know yet, which is why I think we need to lean into this thing rather than just kind of sit back and wait. You know, if we talked to you and your listeners some time ago, none of us had heard of Zika. But it's spreading quickly. I was in a briefing yesterday that showed the spread of this, and it was really quite remarkable. So I think that, again, this is something that the Congress and the government needs to lean into, not just kind of passively wait and hope that it's okay.
You know, I'm reminded by this incident, potentially very dangerous disease emanating from Latin America, of the fact that we are very connected to the rest of this hemisphere. And I just wonder whether you would buy my crude analogy, perhaps, that we had better be paying attention to other very toxic things emanating from Latin America, notably drugs in large quantities. As a former military officer, you know, I'm sure very well, the degree to which we've really degraded our ability to monitor, let alone intercept, such drug trafficking. And there's also talk about letting a lot of folks who have been engaged in that business out of jail. What are your thoughts on that, Congressman Chris Stewart?
Oh, my heavens, Frank, there's so much I want to say. You know, if I could go back to Zika for just a second and then comment on what you asked there. Just 2 days ago, we'd only had, we thought, 3 or 4 cases where travelers, because that's your point, is the international travel and how easy that is. 3 or 4 cases of states in the U.S. that had been known cases from international travel. And in our briefing yesterday, they said, no, that slide is 24 hours old. It's now 17 states. So I think that gives you a sense of how quickly this thing is beginning to, you know, have its presence shown here in the U.S. Now, to your point about drugs, gosh, we spend a surprising amount of time on that issue on the Intelligence Committee, particularly looking at Latin America and Mexico. And 2 things. One is the pervasiveness of it, and then the subsequent corruption. Oh, my heavens. So many of the national police, so many of the national leaders in these states or these nations have become entirely corrupted. But when you have that much money floating around, it's easy to appreciate how that might happen.
I gather a proposition that's often put to folks is you can have the silver or the lead, and that does tend to get people opting for the corruption. Speaking of intelligence and speaking of the challenge that we're facing with the drug trafficking problem, I want to visit with you again, if I may, Congressman, about Guantanamo Bay. There is further indication out of the Obama administration that they are, come what may, notwithstanding the law, going to empty that place. My guess is that in short order, they will turn it over to the Cubans as well, who in turn may turn it over to hostile powers, including perhaps Russia, China, maybe even Iran. Could you just give us your current reading on what's happening on that front and how serious a national security problem that would represent?
Well, it represents a significant national security problem. And as Marco Rubio and some of the other presidents of Canada have said, we should be filling Guantanamo, not emptying it, because we have serious threats that's an appropriate place for them. But this president has made it clear that when he determines he's going to take a course of action, he doesn't care what Congress thinks. He frankly doesn't care what the law is many times. He just goes about doing it and dares us to try to stop him. And I'm afraid that's what he's doing exactly in Guantanamo. I mean, the law on this is very clear. It's not ambiguous. And it is the president doesn't have the authority to transfer these prisoners without congressional approval, yet he's bent ahead on doing that. There's a significant number there that are deemed far too dangerous to ever release. We'll see what he does with them, but what the law says he can do with them is very clear. And you know, if I could just laugh, I mean, the only recourse we have with him many times are through the courts, and what a dangerous precedent. But good news, it's a different subject, but kind of the precedent is worth noting. And that is the courts have found in our position many times. The freezing of the immigration policy in the last few days, the ruling of the Supreme Court on his clean air proposals, regarding climate change. They found in our favor on that. So although I hate to use that as the last recourse, the good news is that even the courts are recognizing this president has gone too far.
Yeah, well, I hope a way can be found to inject them into this, if need be, to prevent what's coming, which I'm afraid is going to be courts getting involved in springing these detainees once they get into the United States. It's a huge problem, and we appreciate your leadership on it, Congressman Chris Stewart of Utah. Let me turn, speaking of that clean energy business, I know that as a man representing the West, you have been very active on this question of the president's war on coal. Give us a flavor, again, from your multiple vantage points, not only as a Westerner and a representative in the House of Representatives, but also as a man very much imbued with a sense of national security, what are the implications of the policies that he's adopted in this regard?
Well, both tactical and strategic. I mean, in the tactical sense, I represent a district that we have coal mines. They're in very rural areas where these jobs are, in some cases, the only jobs available other than agriculture or ranching. And they're good-paying jobs, and the president has entirely jerked the rug out from underneath these people. I mean, he said, once again, contrary to what the law may say, he'll just use regulatory agencies to kind of damn the torpedoes full speed ahead and do what he wants to do. And there are also national security implications on this, although people don't think about it as often. And that is, the U.S. has this abundant supply of coal, and the clean coal technology has made remarkable advancements. And if you care about the environment like you do, and like I do, like I think most Americans do, you want to see that implemented. You want to see that type of clean technology implemented. But when the president was accused of having a war on coal in his first election, as you may recall, he says, oh, no, that's not true. I don't have a war on coal. Well, his actions have spoken very differently, and it's very clear that he has. It's very clear that the last 10 months of his administration, he's just going to move forward on that.
Speaking of your role in the West, you have also been engaging on an issue that I know is very much on the minds of a lot of people out there. It's kind of gotten some poster children that may or may not be desirable. And as we're speaking, their drama seems to be reaching its denouement, namely these folks who've seized federal refugee, I guess it is, up in Oregon. Talk a little bit, if you would, from your perspective, Congressman, about the struggle over public lands and the U.S. government's role in them.
Well, look, it's just an enormous problem in the West, and this is a very emotional issue. This isn't hard. I think it's difficult for people who aren't from the West to appreciate how deep this is in the Western culture. Farming and ranching, and that's not just a job, that's a lifestyle. And it's a lifestyle that they want to protect, and we want to help them protect. And the resentment towards the federal agencies, who with impunity and seeming just entirely uncaring, will come in and reauthorize allotments for grazing and cut them in half. As we said, to take away these coal mining jobs, these things without any input from the local community. So that's where it starts. But, here in D.C., on any given day, we could find people who are protesting. And in many cases, they're trespassing to protest. And the police doesn't do anything about that. They don't go in with SWAT teams. And all we would ask them to do in this case is, to treat them with the same kind of, I don't want to say respect, but to treat them with the same type of caution that they do with individuals here. Having said that, I also have to add that if you're planning a protest and you're inviting people to come and to bring their arms and their weapons, that's a bad idea. And that's not going to have a good outcome, as we've seen. And I just think I would hope that both sides would approach this with a little more caution. There is no one who wins if people get hurt.
Amen. Congressman, we'll leave it at that for the moment. I know you've got to get back to work. Thank you very much for your time, as always, and for your tremendous service to our country in uniform and that you're rendering these days representing the people of the 2nd District of Utah. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Ambassador John Bolton joins us next. We'll talk about Russia, Syria, and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleisch with the Center for Security Policy. The newest twist in the Hillary Clinton email scandal was the discovery of top-secret SAP material in unclassified emails on her private email server. SAP stands for Special Access Program. This was extremely sensitive information above the top-secret level, the compromise of which could cause loss of life and severe damage to U.S. national security. This was not the first report of classified information on Clinton's server. So what are the chances that hostile intelligence services hacked Clinton's email server? Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates thinks the odds are pretty high that countries like Iran, China, and Russia did hack this server. So how did this happen? The reason is that Hillary Clinton didn't think laws on official email and protecting classified information applied to her. If elected president this fall, Clinton will bring the same kind of dangerous arrogance to the White House. I'm Fred Fleisch. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are very, very honored to be joined by the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, among a whole litany of senior positions that he held in the United States government, State Department, Justice Department, and elsewhere. He has distinguished himself both in that capacity in the United States government and in his role as a senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute, and of course on Fox News and in newspapers and other media outlets all around the world, as one of the country's preeminent experts on and practitioners of national security policy. He is, of course, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. Welcome back, sir. It's good to have you with us.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You've recently been writing, John, about Russia, and you particularly called attention to a new book by our friend Garry Kasparov describing Vladimir Putin as seen from one of his most courageous adversaries within Russia, now in self-imposed exile in the United States. What are we to make of Putin at the moment?
Well, I think we have to understand Russia has slipped back into authoritarianism. I mean, it came out of the collapse of communism. We thought there might be a possibility for a free and open society and representative government, and that, at least in the near term, I think is gone. Putin is not ruling as a communist, but he is ruling as an old-fashioned authoritarian. And he has said, and it goes back to something he said, it's now almost 10 years ago, when he was in his first presidential term, he said the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century. So I think you can see what Putin has done in Ukraine, seizing the Crimea, putting in volunteers in eastern Ukraine, cyber attacks against the Baltics, and a whole range of other things as his effort to reestablish Russian hegemony in the space of the former Soviet Union. And I think that's what we're going to see in the next year, because he doesn't know any better than you and I do who will win our presidency in November, but he knows he's got Obama for another year. I think that motivates his policy in Syria as well, and really helps inform his worldview. He knows what he wants to get back to, and that's what he's trying to do.
We're talking with Ambassador John Bolton, formerly our representative at the United Nations, now with the American Enterprise Institute, the author of Surrender is Not an Option. And John, Syria is, of course, on our mind. There is, with Russian help, an assault on the city of Aleppo. I believe it's the second largest city in Syria. That it calls to mind the kind of depravity and barbarism that Bashar Assad's father, Hafez Assad, engaged in the city of Hama some time ago. What's the state of play there, as you see it, the Russian role and the U.S. role, if any?
Yeah, well, it definitely runs in the family. And I think what we're seeing playing out is just a further evidence of what Putin's motivation was to come to Assad's aid to begin with. I think what they are trying to do is consolidate and kind of rationalize the territory that the Assad regime controls. And that means essentially destroying what is sometimes called the moderate opposition. It means going after ISIS only incidentally. And Aleppo, obviously, and up in Idlib province have been strongholds of the opposition to Assad right from the beginning of this conflict, now almost 5 years ago. Russia has extraordinarily expanded its influence, going from an insignificant naval, almost refueling station at Tartus in Syria, now to an increasingly expanding, sophisticated air base at Latakia, bringing in anti-aircraft missile detachments and really building a presence we haven't seen Russia or the former Soviet Union have since they were thrown out of Egypt in the 1970s by Anwar Sadat. All of this has come because of the utter absence of effective American presence in the region. This is Obama's leadership from behind. This is Obama's view that actually it's America that's part of the problem, and that the world, the Middle East in particular, will be a safer, more secure place if we disappear. It's obviously proving to be exactly the opposite, as was entirely predictable. But Russia's on a roll here in the Middle East, and we're still in retreat.
Mr. Ambassador, let me go back to Europe. You mentioned some of Putin's aggressive behavior there, including threats to our friends and allies now in Eastern and Central Europe. The president has decided in his last budget, mostly just sort of a placeholder, I guess, for the next president, but to add something on the order of $3 billion to our spending for the Pentagon to sort of up its presence in that part of the world. What do you make of that? Is it advisable? Is it necessary? Is it sufficient?
Well, it's better than a shark stick in the eye, but that's about it, really. Look, we should be thinking ahead toward hopefully January 20th, 2017, when we get a real president, and what we're going to have to do to repair the extraordinary damage done to our defense capabilities over what will then be the 8 years of the Obama administration. I mean, we've lost, it's far more damaging than just the effect of the sequester. We've lost, by many estimates, close to $1.5 trillion off what was projected at the end of the Bush administration, and that's ex the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In other words, taking them out of the comparison entirely. So we've got a massive need to fund weapon systems that are critical for our ability to project power and protect our interest. And NATO is one of the prime areas there. Plus, we've got areas that I think, frankly, in administrations, Republican and Democratic alike, like cyberspace, we just simply have not done enough either defensively or offensively. So I think what may be happening is Obama's willing to have finally some modest increases in defense spending, because he thinks that way he can say as he goes out the door, well, I did increase defense spending, ignoring the prior 7 years where he was devastating it.
Yeah, it reminds us of Jimmy Carter in his last year, sort of throwing some money at these sort of similar problems, though, as I was reminded the other day, the legacy of Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan was infinitely better than that of Barack Obama to the next president, hopefully, as you say.
Yeah, absolutely. Jimmy Carter is the good old days compared to the Obama administration.
Amen. Whoever would have thought?
Exactly.
John Bolton, let me ask you lastly about a country that you've been following very closely, both in office and since you left, North Korea. Missile tests this week, a nuclear weapons test the week before or so. What is your current reading on the threat we're facing from the so-called Hermit Kingdom?
Well, I think that threat is increasing. I mean, people can downplay the significance of putting a satellite into orbit. It may well be it's not functioning very well, but each test that they make, and I think probably in full cooperation with Iran, brings both of those countries closer to their objectives of delivering nuclear weapons via intercontinental ballistic missile. And we have testimony of the U.S. Commander in Korea, the South Korean Ministry of Defense, all of whom are warning that the North is getting closer and closer to the capability of being able to hit targets on America's West Coast. And what North Korea can do, I think we have to assume Iran will be able to do fairly soon as well. So we've seen an utter breakdown of our counterproliferation policy against weapons of mass destruction. We saw it in the surrender to Iran in the Vienna nuclear deal. We're seeing it in this so-called policy of strategic patience with respect to North Korea, which just simply demonstrates that strategic patience is a synonym for doing nothing. And we're going to pay the price because North Korea will sell that technology to anybody with hard currency. And I think there are plenty of buyers on the world stage for it. The North is a threat in East Asia, but it's a threat globally as well.
A tremendously important point. Mr. Ambassador, we have to let you go. Thank you very much for all of this insight into the challenges we're facing today and your service to our country, past, present, and hopefully future, as we reckon with them, hopefully successfully. Keep up the good work at the American Enterprise Institute and come back to us again, if you would, sir, very soon. Next up, Congressman John Fleming of the House Armed Services Committee will join us to talk about what Congress is going to do about all of this and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Suddenly, a mosquito-borne disease in Brazil known as the Zika virus is arousing fear here, thanks to reports that it can cause birth defects and be spread to at least parts of nations like ours. The Obama administration has announced that it will throw nearly $2 billion at research and other measures aimed at preventing Zika's transmission and impact. Incredibly, another far more deadly import from Latin America is now considered less threatening: burgeoning drug smuggling by narco-trafficking cartels and gangs. While the loss of life here so far to Zika is negligible, more than 100 Americans die every day due to drug overdoses. And some politicians are pushing to release convicted traffickers, most of whom will resume their deadly trade. Let's stop the Zika virus, but we also have to fight those other toxic hemispheric imports, narcotics, and their purveyors. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I couldn't be more pleased to say we are joined by a man I admire greatly in the United States House of Representatives. He is Congressman John Fleming. Also happens to be Dr. John Fleming. He serves with great distinction on the House Armed Services Committee and has duties on its Tactical Air and Land Forces and Strategic Forces subcommittees. That seems to me to pretty much cover the waterfront, but it's great to have you with us, sir, representing the people of the 4th District of Louisiana with great distinction. It's always a delight to talk to you. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. And I'll mention that Barksdale Air Force Base, which is home of Global Strike Command, is located in my district. So obviously the two legs of the three-legged nuclear stool is really headquartered out of my district.
Yeah, well, and I wanted to congratulate you on the second bomb wing getting the best bomber wing in the United States Strategic Command the past couple of days. Let me ask you, sir, while we're on that topic, about kind of more broadly the defense budget situation as you see it. I know that there's been a letter recently written by your chairman, Mac Thornberry, which you co-signed, and I'd like to get your thoughts on the contents of that letter and the necessity for the actions that it's calling for.
Well, absolutely. Remember that the Pentagon programmed in $500 million of cuts before sequestration. Then we had sequestration that cut even deeper. Finally, sequestration was lifted. But now we have a situation where we're at the lower ragged edge just to be able to get by. And now the president is coming out with his budget, and he wants to convert some of the baseline budget of our military into overseas contingency funds. In other words, he's expanding. He's finally fighting back against ISIS a little bit. It's going to cost more money. And rather than going to Congress and looking for those dollars, he wants to dig into the base budget, which is, again, going to cripple our military, our national defense.
Yeah, this seems to be really the pattern, unfortunately. But what is somewhat extraordinary, sir, is that you are known to be a deficit hawk, and together with Congressman Jim Bridenstine and Trent Franks, Mo Brooks, you all have been known for being properly quite concerned about deficit spending, and yet you've joined in this letter from Mac Thornberry, and I guess I'm keen to find out what it is that has moved you to do so in the present circumstance.
Yes, I am a deficit hawk. I believe that we need to balance our budget, but the most important dollar we could ever spend in the federal budget is for national defense. That is my most important responsibility, Frank, as a congressman. And if we can't get that right, if we can't protect our borders, if we can't protect our nation's interest and project power around the world, which really saves dollars over the long term, and I think President Reagan proved that, if we can't do that, then nothing else really matters. So that's why we want to balance our budget, so we will have the adequate dollars, not only to run our nation and to make sure that the trains run on time, so to speak, but to ensure the nation's safety. And so I have no problem. In fact, I would tell you that I do think we need to significantly increase defense spending because the threats are only getting worse. You've talked about it many times. The Chinese, of course, are modernizing and projecting power. You've got the Russians. I mean, Putin is up to no good. And then we've got the growth of ISIS. So it's going to take more dollars. And the longer we wait to modernize and to build our defense, the more costly it's going to be, not only in dollars, but in lives.
Yeah, well, as you understand so well, Congressman John Fleming of Louisiana, the real problem is that if you haven't done that competently, you're almost certainly going to get into wars that would have been avoidable had you prepared properly and maintained a proper deterrence. And in that regard, let me ask you specifically, as I mentioned, you're a member of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee of the House Armed Services Committee, and you do indeed have in your district a command that is overseeing two legs of our triad. What is your current assessment, Congressman, of the adequacy of the investment we're making in maintaining a safe, reliable, and effective nuclear deterrent posture?
Frank, we're behind the curve on that. We have parts in some of our nuclear devices that really go back to 1950s, 1960s technology, and we are in a modernization program. I don't want to leave the impression we're not. But I don't think the resources are adequately placed in order to do that. We're not building new nuclear weapons. You know, we've reduced our stockpile. But the ones that we have, they need to be safe. They need to be reliable. And if ever we have to call upon them, they need to work 100% of the time. So we need to do more in that area. And again, it's been a tough, tough road trying to get this administration to wake up to it. But I will say that the Department of Energy, the DOD, and the departments under the president, I think, are on top of this. I think they've got their head right, but they do have to struggle with the administration and sometimes Congress to have the resources to complete this.
Yeah, well, the larger problem, in a way, is that the president of the United States is committed to a policy of, well, ridding the world of nuclear weapons, starting with ours, as best I can tell. This is a non-trivial problem, to say the least. Let me turn to another area you've been active in, Congressman. You've understood and objected strenuously to what the president's doing in another misbegotten initiative, namely helping the Iranians get nuclear weapons, I'm afraid. You have encouraged legislation and voted for legislation called the Terror Finance Transparency Act. Sounds right. Tell us what it's about and what its prospects are.
Well, I think that I think it would pass the House without any problem. Getting the president to sign it, I think, is a not likely proposition. But it basically sheds a light on terrorism and state-sponsored terrorism, and it puts us in a better position to deprive funding of these things. And so, you know, we're just once again trying to bring light on this problem. And again, the president, as you know, sort of ignores it by if you don't really acknowledge it, it doesn't exist. And so this helps bring it out so the American people will see that Congress does recognize it's a huge problem.
Well, it pains me tremendously that we didn't, you know, prevent this deal from going through in the first place, and then that we missed the omnibus appropriations measure as a means of really forcing this kind of accountability and ideally prevention of money from flowing to these very bad actors. It's mind-boggling, and I fear, again, as you said earlier, Congressman, we're gonna see people's lives lost, sadly, as a result. Lastly, let me just ask you about North Korea. I talked about it a moment ago with Ambassador John Bolton, and you in Congress have been working on sanctions legislation. Yesterday, the Senate unanimously adopted some. Is this really too little too late at this point, or are there things that could materially impinge upon what the North Koreans are doing to threaten all of us?
Yes, I certainly support more sanctions against North Korea. But I would say this is tantamount to pulling up in an ambulance after someone's already jumped off the cliff. The patient probably won't survive. You know, North Korea and how we dealt with North Korea, how Bill Clinton allowed North Korea to get the nuclear arms that they have today and ballistic missile technology informs us of exactly what Iran is doing now under Obama. So if you want to know what Iran's going to look like in 10 years, just look at North Korea today. And in fact, it may even be less than 10 years. So, yes, I still support those things, but it's much better to do it early. And Iran is exactly in the place we need to do those today.
Amen. And you know, this really is such a travesty that we've seen this playbook run on us before, seen this movie before, as they say, and we've learned so little from it. You know, I'm reminded, Congressman, as I'm sure you know, that when the North Koreans launched the satellite, not this most recent one, but the previous one, it, I believe, overflew your state, among others, coming up from the south in a way that looked an awful lot like a test for an EMP attack against this country, as some of our colleagues have argued could well be what they have in mind. This is serious business. We're so appreciative of both you being on the case in the House Armed Services Committee, Congressman John Fleming, and keep it up, sir. Come back to us again very soon. Dr. Peter Navarro joins us. We'll talk about China right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Peter Navarro. Dr. Navarro is one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving China, communist China. He is a multimedia phenomenon, as it happens, in terms of communicating with the rest of us his insights into what the Chinese are up to and what it might mean for all of us. His day job is as a professor at the Mirage School of Business at the University of California, Irvine. He is the author of numerous books, including Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World. He has also turned this product and other videos he's been making into a wealth of very informative products that all of us should take advantage of. He is also the driving force behind a marvelous full-length documentary film entitled Death by China. Peter Navarro, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Always be good to be with you, Frank.
Let us talk first and foremost about some of the perceptions of what's happening with respect to China at the moment. There is, of course, since we last talked, this natty problem that some of the props under the economy of China seem to be being knocked out day by day. Talk a little bit about China's economy as you see it at the moment, the stock market, you know, the problems with the banking industry, and so much more.
Sure, Frank. I think we have to start with the Vegas line, you know, what happens in China doesn't stay in China. And people of the world kind of need to understand how China's unfair trade practices over the last 15 years have created kind of this global economic cul-de-sac, a structural disequilibrium that is descending like a plague now, not just on the Chinese economy, but the European economy, and at least to a certain extent to the U.S. economy, although relatively speaking, we're the strongest in the world. It goes something like this. China, since it joined the World Trade Organization in 2001, has been using this what I call weapons of job destruction. It's illegal export subsidies. It's stealing our intellectual property. It's using sweatshop labor, pollution havens. It's manipulating their currency. They've done all these things quite effectively, mercantilistically, to become essentially over the last 15 years the world's factory floor, growing at phenomenal double-digit rates year in, year out for 30 years. What's happened, though, is that this parasitic kind of mercantilist behavior by China over time weakened its two biggest consumers, Europe and the United States. And so a few years ago, Europe and the United States began growing at rates far below their historical averages. We used to hit here like 3.5% year in, year out. Now we're down to like 1% or 2%. And the punchline is simply the structural disequilibrium is that the U.S. and Europe cannot basically support China in the manner in which it has been accustomed to. And so we've seen its growth rate fall basically in half from 10 to what is probably 5% or lower now. The official numbers say it's fire. And so China is struggling with this slower growth politically because the Communist Party is tenuous at best in the country where they basically sustain themselves by giving people jobs. When that dries up, it's got trouble. And their banking system is an absolute mess waiting to happen and possibly collapse. And, of course, to keep the shell game going over the last few years as the U.S. and Europe have been slowing down, China's been building all these ghost cities and infrastructure, which they don't really have the capacity to use. And then globally, as China's gone down, it's brought down what I call the commodity nation universe, which is Australia that sells them their coal and iron ore. Brazil sells them iron ore and soybeans. Russia sells them a bunch of energy. So you have this global meltdown here. And here in Washington, the Federal Reserve, the Congress, the White House, everybody thinks this is a cyclical problem you can solve with Keynesian policies. You know, like print a bunch of money at the Fed, spend a bunch of money in fiscal stimulus. And they haven't recognized that this is actually a structural problem that you really need to deal with by balancing trade. And so China, right now, is probably in its most tenuous position it's been probably in 50 years.
Peter Navarro, let me ask you about that idea of balancing trade. You've pointed out that we now are running a deficit in trade with China of $1 billion a day. And you've run some sort of back-of-the-envelope calculations, I guess, on what that's translating into in terms of, well, military capabilities on the Chinese part, among other things, to threaten our allies, our interests, and indeed us as well. How would you balance trade? What needs to be done to try to rectify that imbalance at the moment?
Well, let's do the numbers first, Frank, because it's friggin' scary. I mean, anybody listening right now, like perk up, because here's the deal. Like $1 billion a day, Frank, $365 billion a year that we spend on made in China more than we sell to them. Okay, now let's think about what that buys. 1 week's worth of that will buy 20 new Yuan-class conventional diesel electric subs that'll sit on the floor of the South China Sea or the East China Sea waiting to sink American aircraft carriers or Japanese destroyers or Vietnamese submarines. Just 1 week's worth. In a month, Frank, they can use the trade deficit to replicate our entire F-22 air wing, which is the pinnacle of our fifth-generation capabilities. In 5 months, Frank, of the trade deficit with China, China can pay for its entire annual 2015 defense budget. The numbers are crippling and astonishing, and it's not just weapons that China is building with American consumption dollars. They're going in and they're buying basically our companies and our farmland and everything else. So the idea of balancing trade is a simple one that, in fact, the whole system of international trade is based on. I mean, it's axiomatic economics 101 in a free trade environment that if there's a trade deficit, one country's currency should weaken, the other should strengthen, and trade should come back into balance. But China doesn't allow that to happen because it fixes its peg currency to the dollar. And so balancing trade is like essential for this country. If we're going to get our manufacturing base back, if we're going to get our job base back, if we're going to stop mortgaging our future to a communist nation that is hostile to us and has bad military intentions, we need to balance our trade. Now, if you look at the presidential candidates, Donald Trump wants to do it in one fell swoop with 45% tariffs. That'd work. On the other hand, you would hope that the softer path would be to simply to tell China, hey, you can't be screwing around with us anymore. You need to play fair and have them respect us. But they don't respect the White House. They don't respect the Congress. And so we might have to take the hard Donald Trump line.
Let me ask you about this, the practicality of that hard line. You say it could be done. It would work. Can it be done without entailing huge economic repercussions for Americans as well?
Yeah, well, that's the conundrum, Frank. And the deeper we get into this hole, the harder it is to dig our way out of it. Because, here's the deal. Do you want to keep doing what we're doing? That's the question. Do you want to keep giving China $1 billion a day from buying made in China, letting them build this huge modern military because they've stolen all
to threaten us? It goes without saying. Hold the thought. We're going to come back with a second segment with Peter Navarro on all of these issues and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Dr. Peter Navarro of the Mirage School of Business at the University of California, Irvine. He is a best-selling author many times over, many of his books dealing with communist China and, among other things, as he puts it, the coming China wars. He is a contributor massively to the national security and public policy debate about how we should deal with China. And I'm always thrilled to have a chance to visit with him. And Peter, you were just talking about Donald Trump's sort of hard line position on a 45% tariff. And I was asking about what its practical repercussions might be if it did work on China, what it might mean for American consumers and our economy more generally. Finish that thought, if you would.
Yeah, sure. Look, here's the choice we have. The longer we allow basically China to have their way with us, with our job base, with our manufacturing base, the more dangerous the world becomes, the more dangerous it becomes for America. Do we want to keep financing the Chinese military budget with our consumption patterns, or basically do we want our job base back? And so we need to do something. Tariffs are the last resort, but so far everything else hasn't worked, so we are at that point. Of course, this is going to be highly disruptive in the short run to the global economy and the U.S. economy, but look at what's happening now. I mean, you have China collapsing because they've weakened us to such a point. They've weakened Europe to such a point that we can't sustain them. There's great instability in Europe, and so we need to deal with this. I mean, we balance our trade globally, and we don't have to deal with all these stupid Keynesian solutions, printing a bunch of money, doing quantitative easing, cheapening the currency, and creating all this instability. I mean, this is why we have presidential elections, Frank. It would be lovely if the candidates talked about this stuff.
Let me ask you, Peter Navarro, to sort of tease out what is now likely to ensue in China. You certainly have made the case very persuasively that the Chinese economy is in decline and that that is likely to have further corrosive effects on what's left of any public support for the Chinese Communist Party. Do you believe that there is a likelihood you'll find Chinese communists turning to that favorite authoritarian technique of social engineering to prop themselves up, to justify their repression at home by either conjuring or actually declaring war effectively on foreign enemy, perhaps including ourselves?
Frank, in my Crouching Tiger book, there's a great chapter in there on Wag the Dog. And I don't know if you remember the film, but it's the famous American movie about how an American president gets troubled domestically and attacks, creates this phony war. The Wag the Dog is actually a quite well-developed theory in international relations. And it basically says that when a country like China gets in the mess it's in, when the Communist Party gets in the mess it's in, that's when it's most dangerous. And what I'm, you know, one of the scenarios I'm very concerned about, and I write about in Crouching Tiger, is as the Chinese Communist Party weakens, it basically ups its attacks on Japan over the Senkaku Islands, over Vietnam and the Philippines and the South China Sea, against the U.S., because we do have warships over in the South China Sea challenging China's warped view of freedom of navigation. All of these things become triggers for war when the Chinese Communist Party is wounded as it is. So this is a country that is dangerous when it's strong. It's also a country when it's dangerous when the Chinese Communist Party is weakened. So that scenario is concerning. The other thing, and I'll make this prediction again, which I made on CNBC, I think that there's at least some chance that Xi Jinping, the current president, will be deposed. He'll either have a heart attack or get assassinated or be sent away in shame, because this guy, over the last couple of years, has basically just scared the ruling elites there. He's putting them in prison. He's doing all sorts of things in the name of anti-corruption, which is designed simply to consolidate his power. And he's basically angered every major constituency in China. So that's a dangerous situation as well.
Let me ask you, when you look at the South China Sea as a specific focus for Xi Jinping's expansionist policies, and you've talked about them doing to freedom of navigation externally what they have done internally to freedom of speech. I thought this was a marvelous turn of phrase. Suppress, deny, and obliterate. Peter Navarro, that would seem to put us inevitably on a path towards conflict with the Chinese. Talk, if you would, a little bit about what the Chinese are doing in your assessment and that of all of the experts that you've been, you know, tapping for your videos and for your Crouching Tiger book. In terms of preparing themselves for conflict with the United States, should they decide that's necessary?
Sure. Let's start at satellite level. Look down on the South China Sea. Even though it's called a sea, it's effectively an ocean. You've got one-third of all global trade that passes through the South China Sea. And you also have the oil that lights the lamps of Japan and South Korea coming through the Malacca Strait from the Persian Gulf through that South China Sea. Now, this is an outrage. China, based on its so-called nine-dash line claim, claims 80% of the South China Sea. 80% of the South China Sea. And they have got this warped view of freedom of navigation as part and parcel of trying to take the South China Sea from the world, saying that instead of there being a 12-mile territory limit, there is now a 200-mile territorial limit that military ships cannot pass through. And this warped definition comes from the 1982 Law of the Sea Treaty interpretation that has no basis in fact. But it's not stopping them from doing it. So the point is that if you give China that 200-mile definition, you effectively run the U.S. Navy right out of the Asia Pacific. And you've also basically put off limits about one-third of all the existing sea lines of communication for both commercial and military shipping. I mean, this is the mother of all red lines for the United States, which is a trading nation. But China, I mean, it just keeps nudging and pushing and nudging and pushing, building ships upon ships and flooding the South China Sea. We don't have the bandwidth. I mean, our Navy's gone from 600 ships during Reagan. We're getting down close to 200 ships now with no sign of that reversal under sequestration. China's running these ships, one every other day off the shipping yards of China.
Peter, we only have a minute left. Let me ask you the pointed question. When you look at all of this and people say, well, but we owe them so much money they couldn't possibly go to war with us, in 30 seconds, what's wrong with that argument?
It's the same argument everybody made in 1914. Oh, the Germans and the British will never go to war. There's too much trade between them. It's the same argument we made in World War II. I mean, the fact of the matter is, and a lot of the experts I talk to, and go talk to John Mearsheimer, University of Chicago, he'll tell you nationalism trumps economics a lot of times, national security. So, yeah, I mean, let's not rely on economic engagement.
Amen. We have to leave it at that for the moment, but we look forward to further conversation on all of this and more shortly. Congratulations once again on Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World, and your various video products. Very quickly, where can people find those?
Yeah, just go to crouchingtiger.net, crouchingtiger.net. You can get the film for free if you get the book. There's all sorts of cast clips from the 35. It's really cool stuff.
Peter Navarro, thank you very much. Keep up the great work at the Mirage School of Business at the University of California, Irvine, and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.